from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed a joint session of the U.S. Congress Tuesday.
Iran's regime is as radical as ever. Its cries of death to America, that same America that it calls the Great Satan, as loud as ever. Now, this shouldn't be surprising, because the ideology of Iran's revolutionary regime is deeply rooted in militant Islam. And that's why this regime will always be an enemy of America. And don't be fooled. The battle between Iran and ISIS doesn't turn Iran into a friend of America. Iran and ISIS are competing for the crown of militant Islam. One calls itself the Islamic Republic. The other calls itself the Islamic State. Both want to impose a militant Islamic empire, first on the region and then on the entire world. They just disagree among themselves who will be the ruler of that empire. In this deadly game of thrones, there's no place for America or for Israel, no peace for Christians, Jews, or Muslims who don't share the Islamist medieval creed, no rights for women, no freedom for anyone. So when it comes to Iran and ISIS, the enemy of your enemy is your enemy. The difference is that ISIS is armed with butcher knives, captured weapons, and YouTube, whereas Iran could soon be armed with intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear bombs. We must always remember, I'll say it one more time, the greatest danger facing our world is the marriage of militant Islam with nuclear weapons. To defeat ISIS and let Iran get nuclear weapons would be to win the battle, but lose the war. We can't let that happen.
But the Prime Minister has a history of being dead wrong where Israel's neighbors and nuclear weapons are involved.
There is no question whatsoever that Saddam is seeking and is working and is advancing towards the development of nuclear weapons. No question whatsoever. And there is no question that once he acquires it, history shifts. Immediately, the dangers posed by a nuclear-armed Saddam were understood by my country 2 decades ago, well before September 11th. In 1981, the late Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin, dispatched the Israeli Air Force on a pre-dawn raid that destroyed the Iraqi nuclear reactor at Oss Irak. This probably took place months away from Saddam's ability to assemble the critical mass of plutonium for the first atomic bomb, or more than one. And today, the United States must destroy the same regime because a nuclear-armed Saddam will place the security of our entire world at risk. And make no mistake about it, if and once Saddam has nuclear weapons, the terror network will have nuclear weapons. 2 decades ago, it was possible to thwart Saddam's nuclear ambitions by bombing a single installation. But today, nothing less than dismantling his regime will do. Because Saddam's nuclear program has fundamentally changed in those 2 decades. He no longer needs one large reactor to produce the deadly material necessary for atomic bombs. He can produce it in centrifuges the size of washing machines that can be hidden throughout the country. And I want to remind you that Iraq is a very big country. It is not the size of Monte Carlo. It is a big country. And I believe that even free and unfettered inspections will not uncover these portable manufacturing sites of mass death. It's a cat and mouse game, and he's the cat. and he's successful. Successful cat. It is not very difficult to deceive inspectors. It's not even very difficult to deceive satellite inspection. You can burrow tunnels and hide the earth. Did you ever see The Great Escape? The movie The Great Escape. Remember that movie? You know, where all these guys come out and they have the sand which they distribute through the trousers while they're walking the yards. That's essentially what dictators do. They can create tunnels and labyrinths that you'd never discover that are impervious to radar and other means. They can, when you have an entire country to hide portable centrifuges that are a little bigger than those two cameras, it's not very difficult. You can get away with it, and he has gotten away with it, frankly.
That was the Israeli leader speaking before the U.S. Congress on September 12, 2002, about a month before Congress gave President George W. Bush the authorization for the use of military force to invade Iraq. More than a dozen years, a million deaths, and $1 trillion later, Netanyahu's Tuesday appearance on Capitol Hill was seen by many outside of the Beltway as not just a heavy-handed attempt to scuttle a possible deal between Iran and the so-called P5 plus one, but as a naked election ploy, using the U.S. Congress as a backdrop for global media attention, targeting his domestic audience in Israel, where the Likud party faces tough parliamentary elections on March 17th. Yvonne Eland is a defense analyst at the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. He spoke with RT about the controversial address to Congress by Israel's leader.
The reason that Netanyahu is coming for this has nothing to do with the Iranian nuclear program. He's made his objections clear to the White House, and he knows what support he has in Congress. This speech is designed for his audience at home because he is in a tough re-election bid. And just because the Israeli elite goes against Netanyahu, the Israeli people may not. You know, these are always crowd pleasers at home when you act tough abroad, especially standing up to a U.S. president that isn't very popular in Israel. So you don't know what's going to happen with the Israeli election. But Netanyahu is clearly trying to use this to win support in a tight election at home. Netanyahu is a hardliner against Iran. He wants the entire Iranian nuclear program dismantled, which is, it's really a non-starter. They do have a right under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to have peaceful use of nuclear weapons, or excuse me, nuclear power. And according to the Iranians, that's all they're doing. Of course, everybody suspects they're trying to get at least the precursors for a bomb. I don't know if they made a decision to actually weaponize, but they're just not going to give up their nuclear program because of prestige value, and also because most Iranians across the political spectrum in Iran support the nuclear program. And I don't think more sanctions are going to work because, you know, whenever you get a united front in a country, when you put either economic or use economic or military power against them, it usually has a rally around the flag effect in that country. So I don't think more sanctions, which is what Netanyahu is advocating, instead of this deal, is going to work. So the only logical thing to do is what Obama and other countries are trying to do, and that is to limit the ability of Iran to create a nuclear weapon. Certainly, the administration under our Constitution negotiates with foreign countries, so he really can't scrap a deal. What he can do is pollute the atmosphere on Capitol Hill and getting any sort of deal through if they make it into a treaty. And even if they make it into an executive agreement, there can still be a lot of opposition. There's already been complaints of excessive executive action on the part of Obama on immigration. So if he made an executive agreement with Iran on the nuclear program, I think there would be pressure for to have some sort of congressional approval of it. So I think Netanyahu can cause trouble for the administration, but he can't nix any sort of deal that might be signed. Problem is that he always gets U.S. government support, frankly. I mean, this is a domestic political issue rather than a security issue. And what happens is Israel has a lot of lobbying power in the United States, and therefore the United States usually does Israel's bidding. Now, of course, Obama's pushed back on that a little bit, and Obama does have the advantage that he doesn't have to be reelected again, but there's a whole lot of Democrats who do need to be reelected again, and they need the Jewish vote and a lot of Christians support Israel as well, so they need that vote. And Netanyahu is, I think, the biggest news here is that Netanyahu is really putting the Democrats in a bad position because they have to choose between Obama and support what looks like is a support for Israel.
Nevertheless, the negotiations between the P5 plus one and Iran continued Thursday in Switzerland. Press TV's Omaleski was there and filed this report.
Nuclear talks resume between Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany in Switzerland. Before meeting his U.S. counterpart, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif delivered a speech at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. Zarif also met his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, and later responded to our question about how close the sides were to a final deal by saying it depends on whether the political will to reach an agreement exists.
Our negotiating partners, particularly the Western countries and particularly the United States, must once and for all come to the political understanding that sanctions and agreement don't go together. If they want an agreement, sanctions must go. Sanctions, they have to realize, are not an asset, have never been an asset, they're a liability.
The Iranian foreign minister then headed to the Swiss city of Montreux, where he met U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Also taking part in the talks were the U.S. Energy Secretary and the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization. Kerry has underlined the need to give diplomacy a chance amid pressure from Israel. The Iranian foreign minister says that Tehran has gone the extra mile in order to find a mutually acceptable solution. The sides have a July 1st deadline to reach a framework agreement. It's clear that the talks are getting more serious as they progress, but whether a deal is actually within reach after a couple of days here in Montreux remains to be seen. Homaleski for Press TV in Montreux, Switzerland.
In Argentina, President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner delivered her final State of the Union address to Congress just days after a judge dismissed allegations that she had tried to derail an investigation into a deadly 1994 bombing in Buenos Aires. CCTV's Joel Richards filed this report from Buenos Aires.
Boosted by thousands of supporters outside, Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner arrived well prepared at Congress on Sunday to deliver her annual speech. Live on national television, she spoke for more than 3.5 hours. At more than 2 hours in, she discussed the issue which had gripped the nation, a prosecutor's accusation that she had orchestrated a cover-up of the 1994 bombing of a Jewish cultural center, the Amia. Just last week, a judge ruled against continuing any investigation against her.
I've talked about the Amia since 94. Since 96, I've been with this case when I reported the Judge Galeano and the others who covered it up and didn't allow the truth to come out.
Fernandez de Kirchner announced new bills she will present to Congress to boost industry and also to nationalize the train service. She also highlighted achievements of both her and her late husband Nestor Kirchner's governments. Less than 2 weeks ago, hundreds of thousands marched to demand justice for the death of prosecutor Alberto Nisman. He was found shot to death in January after accusing the president of the Amia cover-up.
Of course we have enemies, but these are enemies of the people. And today they are targeting the progressive governments, not just in Argentina, but across the region.
Outside Congress, thousands gathered to listen.
I think she has been receiving attacks, and this is symbolic being here to support her and support the model from the last 10 years.
There is not a responsible opposition that has new proposals, which means that more people support Kirchnerism, which has a clearer and more coherent project for government.
Her critics have long announced that the Kirchner government is coming to an end. But with this speech, the president showed she will continue to dominate the front pages before stepping down in December. Joel Richards, CCTV, Buenos Aires.
The case of the missing 43 student teachers in Mexico continues to generate controversy. After last week's on-again, off-again resignation announcements from Mexico's Attorney General Jesus Murillo Caram, President Enrique Peña Nieto announced the appointment of his successor, and she is already herself in the midst of controversy. In a major cabinet reshuffling, Mexico's president removed the embattled attorney general and replaced him with Aureli Gomez, who is herself now under fire over ties to the Televisa media empire and a lack of experience in law enforcement. Telesur's Clayton Kahn reports from Mexico City.
The administration of Enrique Peña Nieto made its first major cabinet change last week by naming a new attorney general. Aureli Gomez, a now former senator of the president's political party, the PRI, will now head the country's highest law enforcement office.
The challenge that confronts us is to reinforce the citizens' trust in the attorney general's office. We all aspire for an exemplary institution.
Gomez is replacing Jesus Murillo Caram, the former attorney general who has faced profound criticism for his handling of the case of the 43 disappeared Ayotzinapa students. However, some on Mexico's streets see the change as a media distraction.
I believe that all functionaries at a certain level and above, considered to be high officials, those that have immunity, all of them embraced and cuddled by the media.
Analysts, in fact, expressed their concern over Gomez's connection to commercial media and her experience in law enforcement and justice. She is the sister of the vice president of Mexico's largest private media company, Televisa.
The implication of the arrival of a person of that profile could be used for the infiltration of case files or political adversaries of the Peña Nieto government, to be used in the most important television company of the country.
Gomez will be assuming the reins of an institution that continues to suffer in the shadow of national and international criticism over its handling of human rights abuses and resolving high-profile cases such as Ayotzinapa. Clayton Kahn, Telesur, Mexico City.
In Ukraine, the commander of the notorious ultranationalist Azov Volunteer Battalion and his driver crashed to their deaths as they retreated from the village of Shirokin in the Donetsk region of East Ukraine. Their car smashed into a monument built in memory of the anti-fascist heroes of World War II. The memorial survived the hit and did not fall, but the two ultranationalist security agents died on the spot. The accident occurred February 14th, the day before the current ceasefire began. Part of that village is under the control of the self-defense forces, with the other part controlled by the Ukrainian army. As a whole, the ceasefire is being observed, with some lapses on the part of the Ukrainian ultranationalists, who have said they will not respect the ceasefire until the pro-Russian separatists have been conquered. Greece's troubles with debt and austerity are well known, and its political machinations have attracted a level of global attention that perhaps hasn't been seen since the country's classical period. But far removed from the high drama of Grexit threats and debt negotiations, life for ordinary Greeks is a much more mundane daily struggle. Among the city's workers are a group of cleaning staffers whose jobs at the Ministry of Finance were terminated. The ex-cleaners have become symbols of resistance to austerity, and despite the hardships they face, they remain hopeful that better days are coming. CCTV's Irini Zarkadoula reports from Athens.
Hope for the future. After the leftist Syriza party's victory, many Greek citizens expect change. The unemployed want their jobs back. Low-paid workers demand higher wages. Despina Kostopoulou is one of those who lost their job during the financial crisis. She's one of the 600 cleaners who used to work in the finance ministry. Divorced with two daughters, she's now unemployed in her early 50s.
I have been working to that job 22 years. Crisis has made our lives more difficult. My kids and other kids cannot find jobs because of the crisis. What crisis gave is more debts, worse life quality.
Nevertheless, she didn't stay at home waiting for a solution. Along with her colleagues, she has been fighting for more than a year for a resolution to the country's financial problems. They spend days and nights at a tent outside the finance ministry in the center of Athens. Finance ministry cleaners have become a symbol of resistance. Despina admits that it is not easy for Greece to overcome the difficulties, but she is optimistic that the Greek government will negotiate better terms for repaying the debt it borrowed from its neighbors.
We learned from the media that the finance ministry had decided to sacrifice us to get the layoffs needed. We could not believe it. We believe that Syriza will hire us again as promised. I believe that better days will come for Greece, but it needs time, step by step. I believe in the culture of leftists.
Mass unemployment has been a permanent feature of Greek life since the imposition of austerity measures in 2010. The economy contracted by 25% as a result of a recession lasting years.
This lady has become a figurehead for Greece, a country fed up with austerity. More than 1 million people have been unemployed. What they ask for is to get back their jobs, claiming that this is the only way to get back their dignity.
Some say the government and employers have colluded over the past 5 years to eradicate many full-time jobs. Permanent employment is becoming a thing of the past, with a recent survey finding that in Greece and Portugal, 25% of those people working part-time were jobless or inactive within a year. The future for many here remains uncertain. But for Despina, well, she's just hoping she can get her old job back and return to life as normal. Irina Zarkadoula, CCTV, Athens.
Last Friday night's killing of a Russian political figure in Moscow was still the focus of media attention Tuesday. Russian investigators were said to be considering several crime scenarios, with some of them linking the murder to events in Ukraine, the Charlie Hebdo terrorist attack in Paris, or Nemtsov's business activities. And as we reported earlier, former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev said he thought the killing was clearly aimed at destabilizing the political situation in the country and heightening tensions with the West, a view that's widely held in Russia, even among leading opposition figures. For more on this, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer and researcher of international relations and security at the Center for Conservative Studies at Moscow State University. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Monday. So, Mark, Nemtsov is dead. Here in the U.S., they're drawing the conclusion that because he was obviously hostile to the Russian government and to just about every initiative or policy of the government, that the government must be responsible for his death. But the people there that know him have a different view of that. You want to fill us in?
Yeah, I think it's rather interesting. If you listen to the Western media, you hear Boris Nemtsov being played up as a prominent opposition leader or major opposition leader or prominent critic of the Kremlin, of Putin. And, you know, this is so far from the truth of Russian politics right now. Boris Nemtsov was the co-chair of the neoliberal Republican Party coalition Freedom Party of Russia. That's a RPR Parnas, which consistently has polled around 0.5% of the electorate over the last 5 years. All right, Levada, the fairly critical of the government polling agency, which is widely respected, widely used by everyone, government and opposition alike, stopped tracking his party because its ratings were so low it wasn't worth their time. Boris Nemtsov, during the 90s, he was on the rise. There were people, supposedly even at one time Yeltsin considered him for his successor, although he obviously chose Putin instead. He comes from Nizhny Novgorod. That's where he got his first electoral seat. He is well documented in the Russian media, although never touched in the Western press, that he was heavily involved in the mafia there, as was, you know, so much so common during the 90s, this gangster era of capitalism. That's how he gained his seat. He is widely associated in Russia, and correctly, because he was intimately involved with them when he rose to his highest level under Yeltsin as deputy prime minister. He is intrinsically involved, the Russian people consider him involved, in the neoliberal shock therapy, the privatizations, and the corruption that devastated the country so terribly during the 1990s. They are presenting him as some kind of martyr figure. The truth is, the Russian people, by and large, the vast majority, despised Boris Nemtsov. Even further, most of the liberals, this 5% that you saw grieving, that, you know, you may have seen pictures of going to his memorial, even the liberals hated Boris Nemtsov because he had such a huge ego. Boris Nemtsov's party, being one of these liberal parties, did not have a single representative in the country because, by and large, he was despised by most of the Russian people. His values, what he wanted for the country, it just did not reflect what the Russian people want for their country. His personal values and views conflicted with theirs. Boris Nemtsov had four children by three different wives. He had notorious for sleeping with, the jokes are, half the married women in Moscow. And when he was shot, he was walking along, coming from a restaurant, with a Ukrainian model who was his latest mistress. He called his current wife to let her know that he was walking home with his current mistress. This is the life of Boris Nemtsov. He was a playboy, well known for hiring $2,000 a night escorts on his vacations in the Arab pleasure houses that he frequented so much. Any attempt by the Western media to present him as I've heard him compared to Kennedy. That someone tried to compare him to the Russian Kennedy, and you know, Kennedy had his flaws, and there's no question about that. But to compare this guy to Kennedy is such an absolute insult to the memory of John F. Kennedy, whether you liked him or you didn't. It's really unbelievable. It left me speechless. To call Boris Nemtsov a major opposition figure to Putin is like saying Lyndon LaRouche is a major opposition figure to Obama in the United States. And I hope that drives home just how insane this whole narrative has been. He did the Russian, authorities that are in power now, the Russian government, his existence did them favors. Because his very existence kept the population turned off from the liberals. That's how widely he was held in contempt by the majority of the Russian people. His death prevents them with a problem, not only in the circumstances of his death, where he was murdered, it picture frame perfect, where his corpse was lying right below St. Basil's Cathedral on the walls of the Kremlin, then Red Square behind it, on a small walkway. I generally try to avoid conspiracy theories when I can. All right, and I consider the idea that he was killed by the Russian government a conspiracy theory, but because he was quite clearly assassinated and he was a political figure, just about anything you suggest, most of the reasonable suggestions are will be considered by someone conspiracy theories. Now, he was heavily involved in a lot of dirty business, not only during the 90s, but continuing up to today, and there's always the possibility that that could have something to do with it. Jealousy and love and lust issues, that could certainly have been a rationale, again was quite a lecher and was notorious for sleeping with young daughters and married women, that could easily have been a motivation. He recently pissed off most of even the moderate Islam, not to mention the Wahhabists, but even the majority moderate Islamic community of Russia by saying that the Charlie Hebdo cartoons that mocked the Prophet Muhammad should be printed in every newspaper in Russia. The Chechens, all across the Caucasus, they were not very happy with him for comments like that. They find such statements quite offensive, and they in Grozny, there were recently pulled, it could have been up to 1 million people marching in the streets against Charlie Hebdo peacefully, including not only members of the Islamic Church, but the Russian Christian Orthodox Church as well, who stood by with them regarding as a hateful attack on religion. So that's a possibility. certainly, you know, the Western press tries to convince us that the Russian government killed him because they saw him as some kind of threat at 0.5% of the poll ratings. Right. Yeah, and to do so had him killed right in front of the Kremlin.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.